Welcome to Learning English from the Voice of America. Our program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower and use words and phrases especially written for people learning English. Every day, we bring you news and information about America and the world. This is what you will hear on our program. Learn about nature's rarity, blue diamonds. Next, find out about new robotic technology in our Science in the News program. Then, learn about American history on Making of a Nation. But first, this original story.
The president of the European Commission appealed for cooperation between the European Union and the United States. Here is what Jean-Paul Juncker said to U.S. President Donald Trump during their talks in Washington, D.C.
We are close partners, allies, not enemies. We have to work together.
But two new studies show cooperation does not always go the way people might expect. Errol Oxay is an assistant professor of biology at the University of Pennsylvania. He and other researchers have been trying to understand what makes members of a social group cooperative. He noted in an email to VOA that people, animals, plants, and even bacteria help each other. Oxay and his research team's first finding deals with the kinds of relationships or ties organisms formed. Were these connections with random strangers? Or were they with those related or already known to them, such as with family members or friends of their parents? Not surprisingly, Oxay learned that groups with many related connections became cooperative. However, as cooperation became more common, he noticed something new. Cooperating individuals also began to help those they were not related to. They helped everyone. But a few individuals did not give back. As a result, the cooperative nature of the group changed. Everyone began to act selfishly. Selfish societies were not a goal of Oxay's study. So he tried to find what could bring cooperation back. He looked again at the link between individuals. Oxay observed that when making a connection seemed costly, individuals were more likely to limit their efforts. For example, primates spend more time grooming family members than others in the group. Or, as noted in Science Daily, you and I may go to the trouble of sending a holiday gift to a distant relative, but not to someone we just met on a bus. As individuals spent time working on their connections with family members and friends, the cooperative nature of the group returned. And what about those who did not cooperate at all? Oxay wrote in an email that the defectors pay no cost and provide no benefit. But they missed something, he noted. If everyone cooperated, they all would have received more in return. The study was published in the journal Nature Communications. Another study examines how we react to extremely cooperative or generous people. In brief, we don't like those who make us look bad. The study was a project of researchers at the University of Guelph in Canada. Their findings were reported in the publication psychological science. Pat Barclay, a psychology professor, was the lead researcher. He found that people across cultures enjoy punishing an individual they see as too good. They especially dislike very cooperative people at work or in other competitive situations. Barclay says that when faced with a high performer, others can answer in two ways. One is to step up your own game. The other is to bring the other person down. And often, Barclay says, people make the second choice. They claim the high performer is a hypocrite or question his or her real reasons for being helpful. The goal, he says, is to reduce the social benefit such people earn for their generous acts. It is also to avoid having to do better themselves. Barclay suggests that one reason may be found in early human history. If one person was an excellent hunter, the others feared he would take control and become their leader, Barclay said. The group wanted to defend their equal status more than reward a really good hunter. Barclay says he sees a similar situation with activists who urge others to take action to improve the environment or society. Instead of joining the cause, others may choose to continue in their behavior and attack the activist. I'm Kelly Jean Kelly.
The Hope Diamond is one of the world's most famous jewels. It was in the possession of a series of people: kings, bankers, rich women, and thieves, before its arrival 60 years ago at the Smithsonian Institution in Washington, D.C. A rare blue diamond, it has a complex social history, to be sure, but far more so is its geological history, researchers say in a new report. This is the first time anyone has come up with a fact-based study or model for how blue diamonds form, said Gemological Institute of America research scientist Evan Smith. He led the study published in the journal Nature. The group looked at 42 blue diamonds, including one from South Africa that recently sold for $25 million in 2016. Researchers could tell where the stones were formed based on the very small minerals trapped inside. The scientists found the gems can form at least 660 kilometers below the Earth's surface, in a part called the lower mantle. Diamonds are a hard, clear form of pure carbon called a crystal. They form under extreme heat and pressure. The report says that blue diamonds crystallize alongside water-bearing minerals that long ago were part of the floor of the sea. But these minerals were pushed deeper underground during the movement of large tectonic plates that shape the Earth's surface. Scientists already knew these diamonds received their blue color from the element boron. The study says that boron had once been in ocean water, but was eventually pushed into the seafloor rock. Over millions of years, the boron continued to move deep underground. Many diamonds appear colorless. Often, however, they have some yellow color. Still others have a light brown, pink, or green color, About 99% of all diamonds form somewhere between 150 to 200 kilometers underground, a far shallower birthplace than their blue relations. These diamonds are among the deepest ever found, Carnegie Institution for Science geochemist Stephen Shirey said of the blue diamonds. The public can see the Hope Diamond at the Smithsonian National Museum of Natural History in Washington, D.C. I'm Phil Dierking.
Researchers have found a way to use software to teach a human-like robotic hand new skills. The discovery could one day make it less costly to train robots to do things that are easy for humans to do. The researchers are with OpenAI, a nonprofit artificial intelligence research group established in 2015. The group receives support from several well-known investors and inventors, including Elon Musk of Tesla Incorporated. OpenAI researchers announced last week that they had taught a robotic hand to recognize different qualities of a colorful object. The object was a small six-sided box with different numbers and colors on each side. The researchers wanted the robotic hand to show them a specific side of the box. The machine was able to turn the box around until the desired side was showing. The act may seem simple, but it demonstrates a major improvement in how the machine learned to do what the researchers were asking of it. All the learning happened inside a software-based recreation of the real world, or a simulation. The machine was then able to bring everything it had learned into the physical world. That jump helps solve what had been a major problem for robotic hands. People and companies have been able to buy robotic hands for years. But the hands are difficult for engineers to program. Engineers can write specific computer code for each new action. That, however, requires a costly new program each time. The engineers also can give the robots software that lets them learn through physical training. But physical training can take months or even years. There are other issues with it, too. For example, if a robot hand drops something, a human needs to pick it up and put it back. That adds to costs as well. OpenAI researchers have sought to divide those years of physical training into shorter periods. Then they spread them between a number of computers with a software simulation that can do the training in hours or days, without human help. Ken Goldberg is a University of California, Berkeley robotics professor. He was not involved in the OpenAI research, but he did review the work released in late July. He called it an important result in getting closer to the goal of having self-taught machines. In the real world, unexpected things happen. In many cases, a robot's physical training or code might not prepare it for how to react to an unexpected situation. But the OpenAI researchers included noise in their software simulation. That way, the robot would have to learn how to deal with conditions that might interfere with its task. Lillian Wang is a member of the technical staff at OpenAI who worked on the research. She told the Reuters news agency that the group now aims to teach the robotic hand even more complex tasks. I'm Pete Musto.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. I'm Steve Ember.
Three days from now, after half a century in the service of our country, I shall lay down the responsibilities of office as, in traditional and solemn ceremony, the authority of the presidency is vested in my successor. This evening, I come to you with a message of leave-taking and farewell, and to share a few final thoughts with you, my countrymen.
Dwight Eisenhower was elected president in 1952. The following year, the Korean War ended with an armistice, a ceasefire agreement. During his presidency, Eisenhower began a tradition of meetings between the leaders of the United States and the Soviet Union. He met with Soviet leaders Nikolai Bulganin and Nikita Khrushchev. These meetings may have helped reduce the threat of a nuclear war between the two countries during the Cold War. By 1960, Eisenhower had served two terms. The Constitution was changed to prevent presidents from being elected more than twice after Franklin Roosevelt won four times.
We now stand 10 years past the midpoint of a century that has witnessed four major wars among great nations. Three of these involved our own country. Despite these holocausts, America is today the strongest, the most influential, and most productive nation in the world. Understandably proud of this preeminence, we yet realize that America's leadership and prestige depend not merely upon our unmatched material progress, riches, and military strength, but on how we use our power in the interests of world peace and human betterment. Throughout America's corporations. Now, this conjunction of an immense military establishment and a large arms industry is new in the American experience. The total influence, economic, political, even spiritual, is felt in every city, every state house, every office of the federal government. We recognize the imperative need for this development, yet we must not fail to comprehend its grave implications. Our toil, resources, and livelihood are all involved. So is the very structure of our society. In the councils of government, we must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex. The potential for the disastrous rise of misplaced power exists and will persist. We must never let the weight of this combination endanger our liberties or democratic processes. We should take nothing for granted. Only an alert and knowledgeable citizenry can compel the proper meshing of the huge industrial and military machinery of defense with our peaceful methods and goals, so that security and liberty may prosper together.
At the end of Eisenhower's first term, he was still very popular. He had suffered a heart attack, but the Republican president felt strong enough to campaign again in 1956. His Democratic Party opponent was Adlai Stevenson. They had been the candidates in the presidential election 4 years earlier. This time, Eisenhower won almost 10 million more votes than Stevenson, an even bigger victory than in 1952. Eisenhower's second term, however, presented problems. The Soviet Union launched the space age by putting the first satellite into orbit around Earth. Fidel Castro established a communist government in Cuba. many white Americans were fighting the Supreme Court's decision to end racial separation in schools. And the American economy suffered a recession. Eisenhower's popularity dropped during his second term. This would make it difficult for the Republican Party's next candidate for president. The delegates who attended the presidential nominating convention in the summer of 1960 feared that their party would lose the election in November. They had to find the strongest candidate possible. Many believed that Richard Nixon was the strongest. Nixon had been a senator and a member of the House of Representatives. He had been Eisenhower's vice president for 8 years. When Eisenhower suffered several serious illnesses, Nixon had a chance to show his abilities to lead the nation. He showed great strength while facing an angry crowd during a trip to South America. He also gained support when he defended the United States to Khrushchev during a trip to the Soviet Union. Nixon's closest opponent for the Republican nomination was Nelson Rockefeller. Rockefeller was the governor of New York State. He came from one of the richest families in America. Richard Nixon easily won the support of the party. The delegates nominated him on the first vote. He accepted the nomination, and he called for new efforts for peace and freedom around the world. The race for the Democratic nomination was much more difficult. The Democratic Party thought it would have no problem winning the presidential election. Many candidates entered the race for the nomination. One was Senator Hubert Humphrey of Minnesota. Another was Senator John Kennedy of Massachusetts. Humphrey had been elected to the Senate 3 times. He was a strong activist for civil rights and peace. Kennedy was a Navy hero in World War II. He was handsome and only 43 years old. He was also Roman Catholic. No Catholic had ever been elected president of the United States. Kennedy and Humphrey began to compete in state primary elections, the first step in the nominating process. Kennedy won an important primary in Wisconsin. But voters in Protestant areas of that state did not support him. The question then became, could he win in another state, West Virginia? Most of the voters in that state were Protestant. On the last night of the primary campaign in West Virginia, Kennedy spoke about his religion. He said, "The President of the United States promises to defend the Constitution. And that," he said, "includes the separation of the government from any religion or church." Kennedy won a big victory in West Virginia. He then went on to win many votes in other primaries. He received the nomination on the first vote at the Democratic Convention. In his acceptance speech, he said he would ask Americans to help their country and sacrifice for their country. After the party conventions, the two candidates, Kennedy and Nixon, began to campaign around the country. Nixon charged that Kennedy was too young to be president. He said Kennedy did not know enough about governing. Kennedy attacked the Republican record of the past 8 years. He said President Eisenhower and Vice President Nixon had not done enough to bring progress to the nation. Protestant groups expressed concerns about Kennedy's religion. They wondered if he would be influenced by the Pope. They wondered if the leader of the Roman Catholic Church would try to make policy for the United States. Kennedy answered by repeating his strong support for the constitutional separation of church and state. Public opinion surveys showed the election campaign to be very close. Then the candidates agreed to hold four debates on television. In the first debate, the candidates showed they did not differ too widely on major issues. Kennedy appeared calm and sure, but Nixon did not feel well. He appeared thin and tired. Many people who had not considered voting for Kennedy now began to change their minds. To them, he looked more presidential. Most people seemed to feel that Kennedy won the first debate. Nixon probably won the second one. And both men did about the same in the last two. In the fourth debate, they expressed widely different opinions about whether the United States was making progress. Kennedy believed there had been little progress under Eisenhower and Nixon.
Franklin Roosevelt said in 1936 that that generation of Americans had a rendezvous with destiny. I believe in 1960 and 61 and 2 and 3, we have a rendezvous with destiny. And I believe it incumbent upon us to be the defenders of the United States and the defenders of freedom. And to do that, we must give this country leadership, and we must get America moving again.
Nixon disagreed. He believed the United States had not been standing still, but there was more to be done.
It is essential, with the conflict that we have around the world, that we not just hold our own, that we not keep just freedom for ourselves. It is essential that we extend freedom, extend it to all the world. And this means more than what we've been doing. It means keeping America even stronger militarily than she is. It means seeing that our economy moves forward even faster than it has. It means making more progress in civil rights than we have, so that we can be a splendid example for all the world to see.
Another issue in the 1960 presidential debates was the Chinese attack on the islands of Quemoy and Matsu in the Taiwan Strait. And another was how to deal with Soviet leader Nikita Khrushchev. After the debates, the presidential candidates campaigned around the country again. Nixon proposed that if he were elected, he would travel to Eastern Europe and meet with Khrushchev. Kennedy proposed the Peace Corps, a program to send Americans to developing countries to provide technical aid and other help. On Election Day in November, the voters chose John Kennedy as their 35th president. His victory, however, was a close one. Almost 69 million people voted. Kennedy won by fewer than 120,000 votes.
Tomorrow, Making of a Nation continues with the story of the presidency of John F. Kennedy. And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow for another VOA Learning English program on the Voice of America. And find more stories as well as activities and videos on our website, learningenglish.voanews.com.